Spy in the Sky, interview, Ola Demogod, part 3.
We're back again with Ola Demogod, who has written Coup d'etat in slow motion. And we've been through the official narrative of the assassination of Olof Palme. And so now we're going to look at what Olof believes actually transpired on that evening in February 1986. So, Ola, what do you think?
What I'm going to tell you now is it's taken me like 20 odd years to come to this conclusion, and very few people agree with me at this stage. I'm going to tell you, and then it's up to anyone to make their own opinion, make their own investigation and so on, because it's quite far out there. But the picture I'm going to paint is the only one, in my opinion, that connects all the dots and where suddenly everything makes sense, because I come from a background where I call it Farmer Brown logic, you know, 2 + 2 = 4. It doesn't matter who you are, what kind of fancy title you have. If you say it's 36, it's bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I'm
glad you mentioned that word logic, because that's something that I've discovered gets neglected in referring to a lot of these incidents.
For sure, because there is no logic. The logic is the conspiracy. What they're trying to push on us is not logical.
Mm-hmm.
So what I think happened, and like I say, there's so many things around this case that we have not discussed, but that has helped me come to this conclusion. One of them being the very, very strange behavior of the Palme family, that very suspicious behavior of more than four or five of the three or four of the members of this family who have been acting extremely suspicious. And so what I believe happened was that Olof Palme was himself part of the global elite. The group behind this assassination, I call them the global elite, also the people behind the so-called New World Order. And this group mainly consists of three big groups: the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, and the Bilderberg Group. The members of these three groups, we're not talking of the extreme highest level, but I've focused on until this level. The members of these three groups are, according to the way I've learned, the people who are driving the bus, who are forcing this world in the direction they want us to go, not the direction we want to. And it's not, they do not work openly. It's covert all the time with secret meetings and so on. This group, especially if we call them the Bilderberg Group, they pop up every time you look into these type of big conspiracies. They are in the background. They're the ones pulling in the strings and so on, as far as I've been able to figure out. And some of the key players are Henry Kissinger, George Bush Sr., most politicians on prime minister levels, royalties, some famous people, militaries, you got judges, you got all the key people needed in a country to control it without being visible. These groups have their intertangled web of control. So they have handpicked people in all of these positions to be able to control one after the other country. So at this point in time, they're not seeing the world as a collection of countries, but it's almost like a franchise. It's the same system again and again and again being worked out in different areas of the globe. So if there's big similarities between Sweden and Australia and England, Italy, the States, and these similarities are getting bigger and bigger, it's not by coincidence, it's by strategy. They are pushing this agenda forward on a massive scale, and they're doing it on a global scale as well. Anyway, and one of the methods they do this is what they call, by a strategy called problem reaction solution. They secretly create a problem to get a reaction from us, the public, so that they can come with a solution. So, for instance, with 9/11, they wanted to start all of these wars and war on terror, the perfect war that can go on for all, ever and ever and ever. They wanted an excuse to be able to invade Iraq, Afghanistan, and bomb the shit out of all of these places, use all the places to get drugs and oil and all of that. If they had just done that on their own, there would have been an outcry on an international level saying, oh, holy shit, what's going on? So instead of having to deal with all these protests and problems with people reacting against it, they secretly created like the 9/11 incident. So boom, towers goes down, you got a problem. And you make a problem so that you really get a strong reaction from the public. So normally what they do, for instance, with a bomb, they need a lot of images of the children and women and awful scenes to get a reaction so that we would say, oh my God, something needs to be done, please do it. And then they say, well, the solution for us is to, and then that is when you can see the reason why they started all of this.
Then they move the machine forward.
Then they move the machine forward, and we go in the background, yeah, 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 good one, go for it.
Yeah.
So he, Olof Palme, to get back to him, he was a part of this group. He was a Bilderberger himself. He was officially the protector of the weak and the you know,
oppressed.
He was fighting for suppressed, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And he was standing up against the evil USA, you know, and he was doing all of these things. At the same time, he was secretly working for the bankers and these groups. You know, so he was a multi-faced person, in my opinion, and I based that on a lot of research. And he was also a member of the Committee of 300, which is also a very central group in this global elite. They're trying to put all the banks in the world, push them into one global bank with one digital currency to totally be able to control us financially and on all different levels as well. So he was not the nice guy that he was turned out to be. And also the second he was shot, he was turned into a martyr overnight. He got angel wings. And there was this media bazooka that was just being pumping out info about how wonderful he was. It was quite remarkable to see, because he used to be really hated by most people, and then poof, he died, and everybody loved him. Everybody loved him all over the globe. It was very, really amazing to see.
Is
anyway,
that so part of the whole whole system they use, that once they're dead, you can't talk bad about them? I'm relating that to the recent Margaret Thatcher death and funeral.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, she was way up in this elite group as well, dear old Margaret Thatcher, and a nice lady, I would not call her.
No.
When you see, I judge on actions, not on words, you know. She was hard on words as well, so no, that was quite a piece of work. But with Olof Palme, what happened was that he was, in my opinion, once again, he was part of this elite, and this elite on sort of the street level, he was a man of the people. He took his bicycle to work and so on. But at the same time, he was also involved deeply with these elite groups. And one of the things with the elite groups were sex parties they had arranged. There are more and more scandals coming now in England, and so all of these are connected. And where the elite have used prostitutes and kids and whatever. And as far as I've been able to track down, he was part of this as well. one of the reasons they arrange these sex parties is also to get, just like J. Edgar Hoover used to do,
blackmail evidence.
Information on, exactly, blackmail evidence on people, you know. You put them together with a prostitute or a child or something like that. You take some photos, some videos, and from that day you got that guy by the balls. He starts saying something, you just twist it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, twist his balls and he will shut up. And if you see what happened after the Palmer assassination, there's been like a total conspiracy of silence. It's a total, from the official ranks, silence, silence, silence. There's no museums, there's no statues, there's no nothing about Palmer. And it's just silence. You know, nobody wants to touch it, nobody wants to dig in it. When the assassination happened, just days after, there were these strange statements being made by people around him. Quite a few of them said, we weren't even sure that he was dead. You know, these things made my ears go like, what? You know, and also that his body from the coroner's office apparently disappeared for 2 days. Once again, we're talking about the body of the Prime Minister of Sweden. The coroner's office was bombed. There was a bomb threat, and the body was taken out, and nobody really knew where it was for 2 days before the funeral. Okay, and then they found it in a cemetery and brought it back. And then there were people close to him, like his advisor, Carl Lidbom, who's a central figure in this drama I'm going to explain. He said it would be best for everyone involved that the assassination was never resolved, exactly, was never resolved. What does that mean? That in that statement, he says he knows who was involved to be able to say a thing like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you agree?
Because he also because he also knows the consequences of it
exactly
coming out.
And then Hans Holmér, who was the first investigator and also a very central figure in this whole thing, he said, if the truth comes out about this assassination, it would shake the foundation of Sweden. So what does that mean? It means that the truth is not a drug addict who by mistake shot the Prime Minister. It is something that would shake the Swedish society and Sweden as a nation, meaning a big, big thing.
Mm-hmm.
You agree?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, okay. It means they have probably foreknowledge and knowledge of everything.
Exactly. Exactly. So based on that, I started looking into many, many different areas. And there's been two books written, one by a social democrat who was quite high up in the ranks, who it's labeled a kid's book today, but it describes a very interesting scenario, I think. Also, I just want to rewind the tape. A few days, do you remember the Lockerbie
Yes, I do.
Where there was a plane, the Pan Am 103 went down. It was blown up in the sky and it went down. The bomb that blew it up was tracked down. It was not tracked down and put there by the Libyans that was later accused for it. They were patsies, as the normal routine goes. But the bombs were actually tracked to a tape recorder that was placed in a suitcase owned by Bernd Carlsson. Bernd Carlsson used to be a very close associate to Olof Palme. And just 3-4 days before he died, this was a year or two after the assassination, he said to his American girlfriend, I am one of three or four people who know that, I am one of the only three or four people who know what actually happened to Olof Palme. And then a few days later, boom, this thing explodes in his suitcase, the whole plane goes down, and one of the reasons they kill people on airplanes like that is that if you kill somebody when he's on his own, it's very obvious that that is the guy they want to get. But if you kill somebody when he's surrounded by 200 other people, it could be anyone that they were.
Yeah, it's just one person in amongst many.
Yeah, so that is why they try to get people when they're in a big crowd, you know, people they want to get rid of. Anyway, so once again, somebody said that there's a big secret here. What I believe happened was that in the autumn of 1985, in one of these sex parties, Olof Palme, who was unofficially bisexual, if you look at his behavior, it shows quite a clear pattern of him being bisexual. This is not officially, but I've had inside information from quite a lot of different sources saying this. And it seems like in the autumn of 85, like 6 months before his death, he got HIV. He was HIV positive. Okay, so suddenly from having a great career, from having, he was aiming at becoming the new Secretary General of the UN, and so he was aiming high and was really going in the fast lane, and then boom, everything came to a halt with this disease. So the Social Democrats and Olof Palme seem to have had a massive problems on their hands, and if my theory is correct, they had a meeting where Carl Lidbom, his advisor, they call him they call in Hans Holmér. Do you remember Hans Holmér, the guy, the policeman who was later chief of the investigation?
Mm-hmm.
And they call and said, we have a massive problem here. How are we going to solve this? And Carl Lidbom then came up with some different options. He said, option one is that you go out public with this thing, with the disease. 1986 was the year when AIDS became known, more or less. You know, that was the first, that was the year Rock Hudson came forward, and he was the guy, the first famous person who was labeled with this disease, and who will forever be connected with this disease as well. You know, it was so, in those days, it was so filled with shame and horror, this disease. So to go out publicly with Olof Palme having this disease would be a disaster. Also, there would be a big risk of revealing how he caught this disease, and these sex parties and these networks of pedophile and strange sexual perversion type of things would get revealed, which would be a massive problem for this global elite because they are very much into it. Option two that he came up with was, he said, within a few months, you will not be able to hide that you have this disease, because it will start, you will start be able to see it in your face. You know what people with AIDS, and they start getting look really like almost like concentration camp prisoners,
haggard.
So we need to move fast. You know what we can do is, we can do just like with JFK, we can turn you into a martyr, an angel, a legend, by killing you. If we stage an assassination, a fake one, what we'll do is, it needs to be an act of violence to make you into a martyr. If you just died from a heart attack, wouldn't do anything for your career. But to stage a thing like that, we can make you a martyr forever, a legend. You will be forever remembered for all these beautiful things. We can just pump it up and pump up your image and like that. But what we need to do is stage a fake assassination. We will then have a double that can get killed if necessary, and at the same time you will be transported out of the country to one of the castles or mansions of the elite in Switzerland or France or something like that. There you can have a slight plastic surgery, some minor plastic surgery, and the best treatment for your disease ever. And then you can live the rest of your life in luxury. Your family can come and visit you, and you just have to take it a bit easy, not revealing anything. Other than that, these are the two options. What do you choose? And I don't know what you would have chosen, but it's pretty obvious that that would be a way out. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So he agreed, as far as I've been able to find out, he agreed to this. And from that time, from that point of time, in the fall of 1985, he suddenly started his whole behavior started changing. And when you talk to people around him, like his colleagues and the politicians around him, everybody said that he was so distracted. He was not interested anymore. He didn't give a damn about anything that he used to be really passionate about. And also he started stopping different weapon deals that he was part of. You know, he stopped the deliveries of gunpowder, rockets
for missiles.
Different of these.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, that, because these were part of the Bofors scandal, these parts. So he started stopping these and really pissing people in the elite off, you know, because he was suddenly starting to cost them big bucks, you know. They used to be able to trust him. He was always doing them favors and running their errands, and suddenly they couldn't trust him anymore, you know. So he started becoming a big problem. And so in this, at the same time, Olof Palme himself started trying to clear his own name, you know, get rid of documentation that could track anything back to himself, that could destroy the image of him being the angel. And so during these months, while they were preparing for the assassination, he was cleaning his case to his best knowledge. Anyway, what they needed a real professional team of assassins, because if they staged an assassination with people of their own troop, you know, like if they're their own people, if it was revealed in any way, if anyone managed to track one of these people down, they would be able to track it right back to him, and then the whole scheme would be exposed. So even though it was a bit dangerous, what they decided to was to let an order, a contract be written on his head, you know, that he was the victim, but he was part of setting up the contract. And the contract was then given through some Swedish businessman's contact to a man in South Africa, a South African colonel called Craig Williamson. He used to be, he was named a super spy in Sweden because he used to infiltrate the Swedish government on a very high level in the early days, about 10 years before he was this assassination. So he knew Stockholm very well. He knew all the big places like the parliament and all of these places. So he was the perfect guy to do it.
And Palmer also had major enemies in South Africa because he backed ANC, is that right?
Yeah, big time. And also just before his assassination, it was almost like he did it on purpose. He went out so strong against the South African apartheid regime. And he said just a week before his assassination, he said, the apartheid system is such an awful system, you know, it's just stinks and sucks and it's like that, making it really putting, you know, a finger right in the eye of the South African regime, making them even more obvious that they wanted to kill him. But anyway, this contract was given to Colonel Craig Williamson, and he had his headquarters just outside Johannesburg in a little farm called Daisy Farm. It was a little farm in the countryside, but it was actually like a central of terror, of torture and terror. Really awful, awful place. Anyway, so for some months there, Craig Williamson put together a team of different assassins. He used some of his own people, one of them being a Rhodesian guy called Anthony White. He used some West German people who was also working for BOS, the South African secret police. And he used some, he had contacts in Sweden, these right-wing policemen in Sweden. He used a Norwegian mercenary, and he used some American people as well, or one American that used to be, there's some direct connections to the JFK assassination that I can do afterwards. But anyway, he put together this team of highly skilled assassins with no apparent connection, and all of them working indirectly or connected with the Stay Behind movement that, as far as I know, you already presented in your program.
That we have.
Anyway, super. So this team was sent, it was prepared for a couple of months, and then it was sent, they came in, like three of them flew in from South Africa to Luxembourg. They were picked up there by, his name was Franz Esser, West German, but agent for South African BOS. He drove them to Sweden, through Denmark and into Sweden, and then they, in a camper van, and they were hiding out in the forest in Sweden first, and then with the help of these right-wing policemen in Stockholm from the baseball gang, they helped them with the logistics, with weapons, with housing, with ammo, food, all of these type of things. Other people were flown in private planes. Some came in cars and so on. So the whole team were assembled outside Stockholm. And after that, they were split up in groups, and they were put to keep Olof Palme under surveillance from, I think, late November and then January and February. During this time, he was under surveillance by these people. He was a weapon expert and Nazi. He was the one who was supposed to supply them with guns and fake ammo. Fake ammo. But they were not supposed to know that it was fake. Do you see what I'm saying? So the people doing the assassination believed that they were actually killing him,
mm-hmm.
but the bullets were fake. That was the whole idea of the setup. Okay, so in the meantime, when all of these things were going on and Palme was clearing his name, this hit team was getting closer and closer to the date when they were planning to get him. At the same time, there was a series of meetings arranged by members of the elite, because they were, like I told you before, they were very pissed off with his behavior and all the things that he was doing against them and acting totally unreliable. They couldn't control him anymore. And in these meetings, one of the meetings were in Wiltshire in England, and there were people from NATO, there were people from the big banks, there were politicians, there were military people, secret service, different from different countries. And they decided that this guy has crossed the line. We need to take him out before it's too late, because he's just doing totally stupid things. One of the things that they feared the most was that he wanted to make Sweden and thereby Scandinavia a nuclear-free zone, meaning that nuclear submarines and these were no longer allowed in that area, and also no nuclear weapons, and so it was messing it up big time for them strategically. So they needed to stop this at any they needed a big it was very important for them, mm-hmm. to stop him. So they assigned a hit team to take him out, and while they were doing preparing this, they somehow heard of this other assassination plan going on. So if we call them the Palme team and the NATO team, then we separate them, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The Palme team is the fake one, and the NATO team is the one that are pissed off with him and wants to take him out.
Spy in the Sky. Interview. To be continued.